This week on Art on the Air features Nigerian-born mixed media sculptor Lilo Bright, who explores migration, legacy, and identity through hybrid portraits. Next, discussing her late husband Joel DeGrand's August exhibit at the Depot, Amanda Fryman shares both his and her own art journey. Our spotlight's on Chicago Street Theater's production of Bleacher Bums with director Michael Glorioso.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP, 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. We'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight, and it's from the Chicago Street Theater with their upcoming production, one that was actually conceived by Joan Mantegna. Maybe people don't realize that that was a Chicago-based show, and it was at the Organic Theater, and that's some of the history of it. Mantegna was very instrumental in doing a lot of things like the musical Working and things like that. But we're going to talk about something for all you Cubs fans out there called Bleacher Bums, and it's a great show. It's being directed by Michael Glorioso. We've had him on before. He's talked about the different shows. So, Michael, welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight to tell us all about Bleacher Bums and maybe some of the other things going on at Chicago Street Theater.
Well, it's good to be here. Welcome. Glad to be back.
We're glad to have you on.
Yeah, so Bleacher Bums was, you know, it's like you said, it's a Chicago-based thing. There was we did a trivia contest to announce our season very recently. And the one of the questions was, it's like, people are going to be fans of this show, and the other people that aren't are Sox fans. So that's one of the things. It's definitely a lot of Cubs fans, and a lot of Cubs fans who are diehard fans are fans for the fact that they love the Cubs. They're not always winners, but they do try their hardest, and that's kind of at the source of the show. It's you know, being a fan for the sake of being a fan and really finding the love of supporting your team, supporting each other. There's a lot of different things that kind of go into that as well. So it's not only is it just about sports, it's also about supporting each other and really, really rooting for your team, whether they're a winner or a loser.
That's true. Well, the history of the Cubs, especially when this was written, was they were not winningest team and everything. And of course, I'll admit I'm a Cubs fan, but when, like, for example, the White Sox were in the World Series, I was happy for them. I don't have that antagonism that exists. But anyway, let's tell us a little bit about what happens with the show a little bit, in case somebody just has not seen it.
Well, it takes place on a bright, sunny day in Wrigley Field. It has been updated since the original version. The original version was back in the 70s, and they did two rewrites, and the most recent one was done in 1998. So they did update the players there, and right now that's vintage to us because it's 30 years old, about, almost. But they did update the players, but it is kind of taking these bleacher bums, the guys the guys and gals that sit in the bleachers and kind of bet on the game and talk about what's going on, and all the kind of chaotic comic energy that goes on with it. There's also a lot of touching moments. There is one character who is blind, and really they really don't go into the play a lot about when the character became blind, but loves the Cubs, listens to the transistor radio, knows all the players, knows what's going on, and about the people that kind of support him as well and keep them, make sure that they feel like they're part of the game as well. It's a really great, touching story, and it goes through 9 innings of baseball. There's no intermission. But one thing that we are going to be doing that's a little bit unique is that we will be having like a typical baseball game, people going around in the audience actually selling hot dogs and Cracker Jacks and things. That's the plan to do that. And
that'll be fun.
Yeah. So trying to make it feel like you are actually at a baseball game. So that's something that's unique that we're going to try to do with this production. Yeah. Try to do with this production.
And people that are not familiar with the bleachers, how are those different than like the traditional seats that you see? There was kind of a whole thing about that, but tell us the background of the bleachers and how some of the people that went there differed from the other people that was sat. And I guess you call them the old box seats.
Yeah. These are the cheap seats. These are the diehard fans. These are the ones, they don't care if they're up close to the field. They want to see the game. That's what they're there. They're there to see the game. They're there to participate in all the things that are involved with the game, heckling the other team, hot dogs, Cracker Jacks, beers, malts. They're there for the game and the joy of it. The camaraderie. Well,
they're in the sun and the rain too.
So. Yeah, that is a part of it. They're lucky to have it on a sunny day instead of it being in the rain or sometimes the snow. Sometimes we get in this area around the.
Is it still a tradition? And I think this is a real tradition, but I don't know if it's in the play. Is if the opposing team hits a home run into the bleachers, they throw the ball back on the field?
Yeah, it is in the play, and they talk about that at great lengths too, especially towards the end. There is one character that is just there for the money and bets against the Cubs any chance they get. And that does kind of play into the end of the show a little bit about, you know, I'll give you $100 for that ball and that, you know, you caught, but they throw it back last minute. But yeah.
How many actors in the show?
It has about 8 actors, 9 technically speaking, because there is a character that kind of comes in and out. And then and we are also we did do some gender swapping of the cast as well. We got approval for that and everything. Obviously, nowadays you gotta make sure that's approved. But it does make sense, especially with the concept of, you know, there are many female Cubs fans and diehard Cubs fans that are females that I know personally. So we wanted to make sure to identify them and give them the support and the love that they deserve through the show as well.
Yeah, Chicago Street Theater is also doing some other productions coming up. Tell us a little bit about that. And of course, at the end, we'll get back to how to get tickets and information.
Oh, yeah. We are really excited because we're doing the next show after this is Woman in Black, which is a show we've been wanting to do for quite a while. It was made popular by Daniel Radcliffe, the movie that was attached to it. And then we're doing two Christmas shows, Judy B. Jones Christmas, and then The Many Dates of Christmas, which is like a Hallmark movie, one-woman show, which is going to be pretty fun. And then we're doing What She Wore in our studio space.
Well, Michael, that's all the time we have. That's the Chicago Street Theater, Michael Glorioso, who's the director of Bleacher Bums. And that'll be running Friday, August 16th through Sunday, August 25th. Tickets are $22 and seniors and discounts all around there. Michael, thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air Spotlight.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Michael.
Art in the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Lakeshore Public Media is brought to you by Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art in the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BREC.com.
Hi there, this is Public Radio theme composer B.J. Lederman, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Lyle Bright to Art on the Air.
Lio is a sculptor who explores migration, legacy, and identity through hybrid portraits, textiles, and mixed media work. She was born in Lagos, Nigeria, and her work is heavily inspired by culture, friends, and family. Lio chooses materials that express geopolitical and biographical resonance that spotlight themes of matriarchy and migration in the African diaspora. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Lio. It's so happy to be meeting you.
It's so nice to meet you as well, Esther and Larry. Thank you for having me. Looking forward to speaking with you.
We enjoy having you on the show. Well, like with all of our guests, we always want to know your origin story for our audience. They find that very interesting about ours. And I always say it like, how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about yourself.
That's a great question. I'm Nigerian. So I was born in Lagos, Nigeria, which is where I grew up. I went to school in Ikeja, which is like on the mainland. And I would say I always found great interest and passion in being creative. I mean, when you're a kid and in school, it's like art class and like, you know, just doodling and like playing around. But for me, it was always a space to just really let go and like tap into my creativity. And I continued to do that throughout school. I got to university and studied law, actually, which was very different from what I wanted to do. I wanted to study art, but Nigerian parents don't really subscribe to that. My parents are more like, we want you to study a professional course. We want you to study something that gives you a salary. We want you to like, yeah, like have some stability. What is being an artist? And growing up in Lagos, there weren't many examples of like artists or at the time that made a substantial living from it, at least to like common knowledge. Like I think of here in the West, people know like Picasso's and they know like Warhol's and like they're huge institutions that like fund the arts and their opportunities for artists. We didn't have that when I was growing up in the same ways. So for them, they were like, where does this lead to? What path is there? And I just was like, okay, I guess I have to study something else. And I picked law because I thought to myself, I might as well know what my rights are in the world. Law is like universal to an extent. So I studied law and it was really hard, but I'm glad I did. It really taught me more about the world and how things work and like just seeing things from a different lens. And it's really shaped my worldview. And after my law degree and I did the bar and passed, I was like, I still want to do art. And it was that point where I just got like a job at a law firm. And I was at these crossroads of like, I could either like go forward with this job or I could like apply to master's in fine art, which I did. And I got into Parsons School of Design and the Royal College of Art in London. But I went for Parsons instead because I thought it was just such a great program. Like they had a mix of everything, more experimental. And for someone that hadn't yet done any art professionally, I thought that was really a great space to learn and try out things and experiment. So, and now I'm a full-time practicing artist based in New York. So that's how I got from there to here.
So I'm going to take you back to childhood again. And so while there might not have been a wealth of art classes, because I didn't have that either growing up, what was it like in the family? Like, how was creativity expressed within your family? Because I saw the pictures, you know, of your great-grandmother, your grandmother, your mother holding your sister, you know? And so that's like such a wealth of inspiration. So what was like, what was the household like?
I love that question. And I love that picture. I use it for artist talks I do. It's like a four generation picture with like the different women. Yeah. My great grandmother, yeah. My grandmother, my mother, my sister. But at home, I would say culture and creativity were everywhere. You could like feel the the music, for example, we always listen to like Afrobeat and like Afro-inspired music. My dad did have some art in the house. So he would tell me later on that he always, you know, enjoyed art and thought it beautified the home. So he would go to like art fairs, like people would have like little fairs pop-ups, and he would buy some art from when he was in university all the way to like, you know, when they had me. So there was art at home, and we always had like parties and people over, and we would wear cultural outfits. The women would wear these head wraps called gele, which I also refer to in my works and use as a material in some of my sculptures. So I was just surrounded by that, from the fashion to the food to the music to the art in the home. Everything just like reminded me of like this creativity, and like I was always bursting with color and stuff was always going on. So
yeah, color and movement. I mean, it's kind of interesting how much your work, it's like such a static material, glass, that you bring so much movement and life into it. You know, it's really, so actually I want to talk about glass for a minute.
Okay.
So did glass come first, or did the idea for the work come first? Like, so were you thinking of like work and then you were introduced to glass and thought that that was a good pair, or how did it all happen?
Yeah, so I had been making these portraits and like busts and sculptures self-portraits initially, and then of my mom and like other women in my family and friends. And they were mixed media sculptures. So the idea came first. The sculptures would have these head wraps in them, and then these like facial markings, which signify tribe and culture in Nigeria and most of West Africa. And I had these wooden bases for the busts, like to put the portraits on. And it just became like a whole piece. But over time, I watched this show on Netflix called Blown Away. It's a glass blowing reality TV show. I love reality TV shows. I was like obsessed, and I really enjoyed, you know, seeing people work with glass. For me, that was really new. I hadn't seen that before. So it was an opportunity to be like, oh, you know, bookmark that people actually work with glass in the like glass blowing, kiln forming. And I went to an artist talk and met the director of the program there at Urban Glass, which is in Brooklyn, New York. It's a public access studio for glass making in general. And someone introduced me to the director, who told me about their classes. So they offer classes to people of all ages and in different forms of glassmaking. So I signed up and did a kiln casting class, which is where you basically make a sculpture in clay, you make a mold around it, take out the clay, and then you melt glass in your mold. And I really enjoyed that class. So I started to shift my ideas that were already existing into glass. So the ideas came first, and then I then came across glass and the opportunity to learn and use that as a vehicle to transform the mediums I was using.
Yeah, because to me, your work, when I look at it, and let's say I knew nothing about how long you've been in New York, or just the work as the work, to me, there's a deep longing of home or connection. There's a... especially like to ancestry and heritage. And then you read about the work, and then I was so pleased that a lot of the choices you make are native choices to Nigeria, like the trumpet flower. And, you know, so there is that sense of deep longing of place and history. Was that the genesis of it, I guess, or the initial work?
Yes, I would say so. I do think that there's a lot about the works that is a reflection of where I'm at. Like, I do think a lot about home and family, and I let my works just come naturally to me. I don't try to edit them. I try to make as the inspiration comes, and like, I just try to go with my gut more often than not. Like, why am I leaning to this material? Or what is it about these flowers and types of flowers that I want to render in glass? Why do I want to abstract the portrait? why do I want to make works about migration? I do find myself overlapping in my story with the themes of the work. And that's partly why I'm so excited to be able to like have different interpretations of using the glass. It's like different viewpoints of checking in on all those themes and using it to convey wider ideas.
I notice in a lot of your work, you may have touched on this a little bit, is the use of faces. And so are these inspired by the people you know? I think you might have touched on that a little bit. Maybe expand on that. And do you work from a sketch of their face or a photograph? So tell us about that process.
Yeah, that's really observant of you, because the faces are like a huge part of the works I do. I have different streams of work. Some are more abstract, but with my figurative works, those are based on women, especially, and women in my family, thinking of like what gets passed down from like matriarchal knowledge and legacy, and also thinking of friendship and sisterhood. So I also make portraits of my friends and people I know who also have their stories linked to the African diaspora or migration or both. And the process involves a bit of everything. I do take live casts, which I use like silicone to take live casts of people that I know. It's a very intimate process, but it feels like I'm taking a visual picture. I think of it like photography. It's like an imprint of someone's face at a time in their life. You know, like a face makes me think of a mask in terms of like African culture. Masks are really huge. And you think of that tradition and it's like, that's how you present. That's how you're perceived. I think about the face in the same way. Like, you know, people have been through so much and we wear different masks to navigate, you know, our lives. And depending on what stage of life we're at, I think of that as a different mask of navigating that life cycle. So I'm really drawn to taking an imprint of people's actual faces. And I also sculpt. I also make busts like from scratch in clay. But those are more fuller busts, like from the head to the neck, and they stand alone on pedestals, which is very different from the masks I do. Those are like relief wall works. So I do both sculpture and face casts. Yeah.
So when you're standing in a room with your work, it must feel like family and friends are all around you anyway.
Yeah, it's
like a very comforting feeling.
It's community. It's also storytelling. I like to think of it as storytelling because like we all have connections. We all have friends. We have community. And we know their stories to a large extent. But for me in that space, it's like I have a intimate connection with all these people, but it's also a way of thinking through their life paths and the stories and their journeys in relation to mine.
So you have several exhibits going on through the fall. So mm-hmm. What are you working on now? What is the next, you know, what is the next leap, I guess, in work?
Yeah, the next main exhibition I'm working on is a solo show with Halsey McKay Gallery. It opens August 17th, and it's on view till, I believe, October 24th. I am also going to be participating in the Armory Show in a group presentation. Yeah. So if anybody's in New York for the Armory Show, they should come through. And I will also be participating in 154 London. It's an art fair at Somerset House in London. And I'll have a solo booth there with Superposition Gallery. I will also be doing the NADA art fair, I believe. Details to be confirmed. And an art fair.
This has been a whirlwind.
It's a really? Lot. There's a lot going on. There is... Also, well, I will be
so the Halsey stuff is already done, right? I mean, your work is completed for the Halsey exhibit, pretty much, well, isn't it, if it's in August?
Almost done. Working on it. In the last stages, or I'm halfway. So it's going to be a busy few weeks leading up to that.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, like maybe the work is going to go with you on the plane.
I mean, I don't think so, but it'll be close. I've got this.
Do you know what, after all of this, you know, after you finish the work for London, so you said you're still working on getting the work done for Halsey. So do you know what you're going to be working after all of those commitments are done? I mean, do you have your next spark of inspiration?
I really just go with the flow and work. One work comes after another. I'm not really planning ahead. For instance, with the Halsey show, I'm making sculptures and I'm also making relief wall works, but I want to have an installation possibly. So all these things I'm working on concurrently and simultaneously. Also for the London presentation, I'm working on that as well. So the next phase will just come in that process. It's not that I already know what it is. I think when I see all the works together, then it starts to make sense that these works are actually different or different streams of work. But I'm actually just in the studio making work as it comes, which is a bit chaotic. My studio right now looks like things are all over the place. It's like my mind. But then in the show, it will look very consolidated.
Now, with your art, you've obviously found a niche, but do you ever think about, well, maybe I should still do some lawyering on the side, like, or maybe even helping artists with their work or, you know, doing that type of thing, since you have passed the bar exam, which is usually pretty tough. But I often think, you know, this course not taken, you're busy with the art, but yeah, maybe I could do something with the law.
That was what my parents would have loved for me to do. My dad would be so happy to hear you say that. But no, not for me. I think it takes so much to like delve into your mind as an artist and stay there, because you can lose inspiration easily.
Right.
And you kind of get in a headspace of like finally getting the inspiration, finally getting your medium and time to learn these materials. To do law, again, so much skill and time. It's a different like entire use of your brain.
Right.
And I don't think it's possible to shift in between. A lot of people try that. I know a lot of people that have day jobs, but the people that I know that do usually pick jobs that don't require too much of them in that thinking, like, you know, full expertise level. They're more like assisting in a role or doing something that's like, you know, programming or otherwise. For me, I couldn't. I just feel like when I was doing law, I was so embedded in it.
Oh, sure.
And then in art, I'm so embedded. Like, my brain can't handle all that. My work would look so different, too.
Well, it's like a lot of actors who, because they don't always work all the time, but they do like medical transcription, which they actually, in the theaters I worked at, they would actually do it on the computer when they were off stage doing that type of thing. And yeah, so it's kind of interesting. So the other question I have for you real quick is, is there another type of art that you'd like to do? I mean, you've kind of mastered what you are doing now, but is there something else that you say, well, gee, I would really like to try oil painting or something else? Or is that something for you to explore?
Yeah, I have thought of that. I like that question. I have thought of printmaking. I did dabble many years ago, but there is something about like papermaking and printmaking that, and it's just really interesting to me. I love that you're building layers slowly to accumulate into like a finished work or finished image. And I would love to give more time to that. But that's the kind of thing that you need the facilities, you need the equipment, you need the training. And I've considered applying to those residency programs. Like, that's why I live in New York City. There's so many residencies and opportunities to like try out a new skill or type of making. And I love that. So for the future, I would consider that for sure.
I have a quick question. Well, maybe not so quick. I hope it's quick. So when I'm looking at your work, there was the one piece in particular, Bloom in Spring, Green and Purple. So before that, before I saw that one, they were mostly like orange flowers, like they'd be a mono sort of palette. And so when did the color come in and were there more pieces? I mean, I did notice like, there was like a variety of like oranges and I couldn't really tell for the image so much, but there were like two pieces that had a mixture of color. So what inspired the move into the bright burst of color?
I'm really glad you picked on that because it's a very unusual story and I'll tell it really quickly. But basically I had this like whole palette. I was like, I love working with black glass and like golds and like iridescent glass and like a few had colors, but not much. And at the supply store where I get my glass from, they had a really bad case of being flooded. And it was like 8 feet of water or 10 feet of water in the store. And it kind of washed away all the glass. And it was a big old mess. So basically, they did a discounted sale. And anybody who works in glass will tell you it's not the cheapest medium. So when you see a sale, you're like, yes. And it was all these colors that normally a 5 pound jar goes for, like, for pink. Pink is like the most expensive color. Would be like 170, 180. And it was like $20. And I was like, oh, I'm getting me some color. So I just like bought a ton of discounted color. And I was staring at the jar. I was like, now what? Like, so I just started mixing and colors and playing around. And I didn't do any courses on color theory at Parsons. So I was quite nervous. I'm like, okay, you know, would this be a bad color choice? But then again, it's like going with your gut. Like, I was just like, well, I'm going to do it. And then we'll find out if it worked. Like, just go for it. Yeah. And I'm really glad I did. Again, it's a case of things just fell into place. And, you know, I wanted to take advantage of that sale. But now it's changed my practice. And I really love, like, things like that when they happen. It just takes you in a new, interesting direction. And I'm always open for that.
Well, you know, we only have about a minute left here, so we want to give you a chance to talk about your upcoming exhibits and how people can find you online, website, Instagram, all those type of things, and social media, and maybe how people can get in touch with you. They want to maybe have a commission.
Yeah, that sounds great. So I do have the Housie McKay show in the fall, Armory show, which people should look out for, and 154 London at Somerset House also in the fall. My Instagram, which I'm mostly on Instagram, is Layo Bright. So that's LayoBright. And my website is my name, layobright.com. So on the contact section, people can email me. There's like a contact link. And I also have spring stuff in the spring next year, but I will post that on my social media. And I have a newsletter on my If you go to my main page on my website, you could sign up for my newsletter and get the news as soon as, you know, it comes out.
Oh, that sounds great. Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air. That's Lyle Bright, a sculptor in New York, and she's got a working primarily in glass, but she might explore printmaking down the road. Lyle, thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air and sharing your art journey.
Thank you so much, Larry. Thank you so much, Esther, for having me. This was a great conversation.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it tremendously. Yes, and your work as well.
Thank you.
Our show relies on the support of not only our show underwriters, but also our listeners who make donations to this station. Your support of this station will ensure Art in the Air may continue bringing you the best of the arts and culture programming for Northwest Indiana and beyond. If Art in the Air is important to you, please consider supporting this station with a one-time contribution or even making an ongoing sustaining contribution. For information on how to make a contribution, go to this station's website or our show website, breck.com/AOTA. And thank you. Did you know that you can also listen to Art in the Air anytime as a podcast at Lakeshore Public Media's website, through Lakeshore's app, or from NPR? Plus, it's available on demand from your favorite podcast website, including TuneIn, Spotify, Amazon Music, Pandora, Apple Music, iHeartRadio, and many more. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell it to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts.
This is Terry O'Reilly, host of Under the Influence, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Amanda Fryman to Art on the Air. Amanda will be speaking with us about the work of her late husband, Joel DeGrand. Joel was a photographer from early childhood and taught art and photography from 1968 to 2016. He participated in numerous one-person, group, and group exhibitions, plus workshops in the United States and abroad. His work is included in many museums, corporate and private collections, and publications. He self-published 17 books of photography and won many awards over the years, including an NEA grant for the arts. Joel's solo exhibit titled Iterations Beyond Photography, Joel DeGrand, will be opening August 16th, 2024 at the Beverly Shores Depot Gallery. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air, Amanda. Aloha and welcome. It is so nice to see you.
Aloha. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
Amanda, we always usually have our guests talk about themselves, and maybe we'll do that briefly before you have you talk about Joel. So just tell us a little bit about yourself in terms of your involvement with the arts or involvement with that, and then we'll move on to like talking about Joel and what we usually like to say their origin story, like where he started, how he got from where he was to where he is now into this exhibit. So tell us first a little bit about yourself and then about Joel.
Okay. See, I was born and brought up in Boston, Massachusetts. I was making art from the time I was little, making art and making theater. I started out in the publishing business and elementary and high school textbooks. And I was very, very lucky to move into the fine art publication business. I worked at Bullfinch Press, which had originally been the New York Graphic Society, producing art books in Boston, and then I moved to New York, and I worked at the Museum of Modern Art producing art books, and then I came to Chicago to work at the Art Institute to produce art books, and then in 2006, I left to start my own business with a partner. My partner, Joan Summers, and I had a company called Glue and Paper Workshop, and we produced art books for museums all over the country until about 2 years ago. The pandemic sort of, you know, with everybody, made a big difference. I met Joel after I moved to Chicago in 1998. he was my cat sitter. that's how we met. We had a mutual friend. I moved to Chicago. I was traveling for work all the time. I needed somebody to look after my cats. He was going through a divorce, needed a place to stay. So for 2 years, we were like ships passing in the night. He took care of my cats and I went off and saw the world. And then eventually we figured it out that we were meant to be. And, that was about the time that we moved to Beverly Shores and we met and we got together in 1999. We moved to Beverly Shores in 2000 and lived here ever since. And it's a fairy story, actually.
So tell us a little bit about Joel's origin story as much as you can. And, you know, obviously we got to the point where you intersected, but, you know, where he was born, all his story.
He was born in Katanning, Pennsylvania, which is a sort of coal mining town in western Pennsylvania in 1944. And his parents were undertakers. So he grew up in this extended family in a funeral home, which really, I think colored, you know, a lot of who he was and what he was doing with his art. He was the first person in his family to go to college. He won his first camera when he went to a bingo game with his grandmother. He's about 13 years old, and he won $100 and bought a Polaroid camera. And that was his first camera. And then he went on to work as the lead photographer at the local town paper. And so he was a photographer. He's one of the few people I know that always knew what he wanted to do. And went to the University of Indiana, University of Pennsylvania, and graduated with a degree in art education. There was no photography program. Taught high school, and then he found his way to Oregon. He heard about a workshop in Oregon, so he in 1970, I think he went out to Oregon, and he. Started a graduate program at the University of Oregon with a guy named Bernie Freemaster, who was connected to all the great West Coast large format view camera photographers, Ansel Adams, Minor White, Weston, Imogene Cunningham. So he was really, really privileged and excited to be a part of this group of people who were really at the, you know, photography was pretty new. Fine art photography was pretty new at this point. So he that's when he sort of honed in on photography as being, you know, really pursuing his art. But also teaching, he became a graduate teaching fellow. And then, In 1975, he went, he and two friends did the bike, the rehearsal tour of the bike centennial that was set for 76. And they traveled from Astoria, Oregon to, I think it was Wilmington, Delaware. They took 6 months bicycling across the country. And he photographed that. That was one of his long projects that he was, that he was very proud of. And that trip he was very proud of. And then he taught for a year at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, and then moved back to Pittsburgh, where he lived for the next 10 years, taught at Carnegie Mellon, taught at University of Pittsburgh, had his own commercial photography business. And then he worked with a group called Pittsburgh Filmmakers. I think they're still there, but he started their photography program. They were teaching film, but he started the photography program. Met his first wife, had two kids, Kara. Well, Colton DeGrand was born in 1987. Anna Kara was born in 1988. And soon after, they moved to Chicago. And he was trying his hand at commercial photography in the world, in the advertising world in Chicago, which I think he didn't like very much. He and I met around that time, and he turned to, you know, I was the breadwinner, and he was really pursuing his art. He did teach at Columbia. He was an adjunct professor at Columbia for almost 20 years. And he was also an adjunct at Moraine Valley Community College. I think that brings us up to date.
Such a resume.
Wow.
Yes. I wonder, did he know Peter LeGrand from, I think, Columbia?
Probably.
Yeah. Okay. I took a couple of workshops from him. So yeah.
Okay. Yeah. He was the darkroom guy, you know, especially as years went on and they continued to teach darkroom, and he was, you know, that was his world, and it was not the world of the younger, you know, the younger teachers. So, and also at Moraine, I think Moraine held on to their darkroom program even longer. So he was still, and I don't know if they're still doing that. You know, I hope so. I hope that's still something that's being taught somewhere, and that it's not an art that's going to die.
So Amanda, Joel has so many portfolios, so many bodies of work. How did it come about that you chose Iterations for this exhibit?
You're right. He taught, he worked, his portfolios were, he worked in projects. So the bike trip was a project. I got to mention that when he was in Pittsburgh, that's when he got his NAA grant, and he photographed Pittsburgh over a 10-year period. And that was a major portfolio that ended up in a lot of museums. He started photographing people. When we went to China in 2008, he did a workshop with some Chinese students and some US students in 2008, and he brought his view camera with him, and we were in Tiananmen Square, and he was really interested in the uniforms of the Chinese guards. So he started photographing people there, and then he you know, from that point on, he was photographing people. This iteration project, that is what we're going to show at the depot, came out of it. He called it Iterations because he considered this a repurposing of his uniform project. So he photographed people in uniforms for several years. And then the iterations are life-size, multimedia, 3D.
Heavily embellished.
Heavily embellished, and they haven't been seen as a group. They've been seen here. There's, you know, the few shows we've had since he produced them, there'd be one here, two there. This is the first time that people are going to see as many as we get into the depot. There are 14 total, and I don't know if we can get all of them in, but we're going to do our best. And it was really Meg Barrow, the curator, who got very excited when she saw them and thought this was something that people, I know people are going to be thrilled. The iteration started, he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in 2016, and he never said anything about why he was making them, because he was a man of very few words. He did not have a lot to say, and he did not have a lot to write, but he said it all through his art. And so these 14 works were created between 2016 and his death in 2022. And they are, I think they're remarkable. They are joyous. They are such interesting character studies. He said that he wanted to capture the whole person, and he was really interested in how costumes impacted the way somebody, you know, came across. He always had them look right at him. So every single portrait, the person is looking right at you, and wherever you are in the room, those, you know, you're being viewed by the sitter, but also I feel like it's Joel looking back out at you. So they're really fun. They're very unique. I consider them to be the jewel of the crown.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM on WVLP 103.1 FM.
You know, I remember, Joel, the excitement when he was telling me about when he just first started embellishing these photos. There was so much joy in his telling of it. It was just like this whole world opened up to him with jewels. And
he said that he got to use some of the skills that he went back to his art school training. You know, he did this, you know, art education degree. So he had done painting, drawing, sculpture, collaging, and he brought it all back into these works. So that's why we're calling it Beyond Photography. The other thing is, he was a career photographer, and the arc was from, you know, really the day of fine art photography through the iPhone. And I think he was really upset that everybody considered themselves a photographer now because they could take a picture on their phone. So he stopped calling himself a photographer, and he started calling himself a visual artist. And this body of work comes out of that as well. You know, he wanted to go beyond, he took it beyond photography and just sort of took everything that he'd seen and learned in his lifetime and invested everything into these 14 works.
You know, I got a question about his process, and you kind of touched on that. And, well, a couple things. One is that, like Edward Hopper with Josephine, you were a subject of one of his iterations and everything. So follow his transition from chemical photography, we'll call it, to digital. Did he really embrace that whole process? Or, you know, there are some people that just absolutely, oh, no, it got to be chemical photography. I'm of opinion that Ansel Adams, were he alive today, would totally embrace the digital world and everything. But tell us about his feeling, Joel's process, and how that's evolved over that time.
Well, he certainly, you know, he was old school for a long time. He taught darkroom, so that was his milieu. But he started teaching himself digital. He got the early Photoshop and started playing with it, and he really taught himself how to use that program. And he had a darkroom studio in the house, but at the same time, he was working to teach himself Photoshop. And I think, you know, it's clear in these iterations how much he enjoyed that process. You know, these are combination. He would use his 8x10 view camera to photograph the subject, and then he would scan the negative and then use Photoshop to embellish. So it really, they are also a really interesting combination of old and new in that way.
Well, yeah, that you were talking about how he changed, kind of, he's called himself visual artist. I do photography also, but I usually list my fine art photography as photographic artist, you know, so, and some of the things that I modify, I do a lot of my things on canvas, just as a side note here, but if I take some of the processing, like you were talking about, I call it a digital illustration or a digital photographic illustration. It's based on the photograph, but I do that. So that's wonderful.
That's actually, I think he would appreciate that, calling them a digital illustration. I should be clear that not everything is Photoshopped. He also did, as Esther said, he embellished the canvas. So many things are attached to the canvas. There are beads, buttons, sequins, ropes, lobster buoys, and they're also motion activated sound. They have a motion activated sound chip. He worked very closely with my brother-in-law Michael Fontenot, who's a fine musician, and the two of them collaborated on these little 1 minute sound bites. So each one of them can be turned on. I have a lot of them in my house, and I have to turn all the sound off so that I don't set them off every time I walk by. We'll see what Meg wants to do about that in the gallery. I don't think we can have them all running at the same time. But they're, you know, but that makes, so they really, they cover the gamut in terms of the senses.
Life size in itself is spectacular, you know, and then you add everything else. And I just can imagine that room will be filled. I mean, just with the presence of those photographs.
It definitely exciting. Will. It will. And I should say that one of my Beverly Shores colleagues, Joe Gallo, did a documentary film about Joel in the last couple of months of his life. And it at the very end of the interview, Joel starts talking about what he's going to do next. And his plan was to try and develop these into three-dimensional objects. And he was looking at mannequins. He was really interested in AI and how he could work with AI. And he was going to have a mannequin protruding through the canvas. And the last thing he says on that interview is, you know, this is what I'm going to do next. And so we just let use our imaginations. Beautiful. Well, we just use our imagination about what that might have been. But these really say a lot. These 14 really say a lot.
So have you done anything more with your art? I mean, you did to the other, but have you pursued anything more with that yourself?
Yes. Thank you for asking, because I sort of left off, didn't I, when I said I went into this career of art book publishing. I over the years, I've continued to paint and draw, and I really love collage, and I've done a lot of collage. After Joel died, I decided that he would not go to bed at night if he hadn't been in his studio. And I've never been like that, but I decided that I was going to have him be my inspiration. So I've been much more involved in my, you know, and working as an artist since his death. And more recently, I've been working with clay. I've been hand building, and I've been making, sort of parlaying some of the things that I was doing in two dimensions into three, and making clay flowers. Really, really enjoying a whole new substrate to work with. And I carry him with me.
Well, that's great. That's great.
I think clay is so healing.
It is healing. I agree.
The very process. I mean, I find the preparing of the clay very soothing. You know, like everybody was always like talking about hating wedging, but I always loved the wedging part, you know. And
that's great.
it maybe has kind of what they call a grounding effect, because clay is of the earth. And just like they say, especially if you go to a new location, they say you go barefoot out on the ground, the actual earth ground, and it gives you a sense of grounding. And maybe that's the same thing. And I haven't worked with clay, but it sounds like that whole process of manipulating everything kind of has a grounding effect.
That is absolutely brilliant. I love that. And I've needed that. So that explains everything.
So you touched a little bit about the exhibit and everything, and you know, we got a few more minutes left. So what exactly how many pieces, everything like that?
We're still working on how many we can put in there. Hopefully between 10 and 12, I would say. Also, I'm going to be doing a gallery walk with Meg from 4 to 5 before the reception, which is 5 to 7 on August 16th. So I'll have an opportunity to speak directly to some of the pieces that we're showing. And I'm looking forward to that. Probably have some other, some of the earlier works, the uniform works, just as a reference to where these came from.
Does he have prints available of his work that maybe, I don't know if you thought about that, but maybe have prints of his work that would be available at that time?
I am hoping that we will be able to sell some prints through the shop. We're still coordinating all of this, but yes, I am very much hoping. And yes, prints are available. His website is degrand.com, and there, you know, and I am on the other end of that, happily taking orders. I do have a large body of work.
And do you have a website of your work?
I am working on it. It's not up yet, but it will be afryman.com when it's up.
Fantastic. So let's go ahead and hit the dates of it, the show. And you talked a little bit about the gallery walk, opening reception, and everything, and how long the show's going to run.
It's going to run until September 15th, and the depot is open every weekend. And I don't have the hours, I'm afraid, but it's the Friday night, all day Saturday, all day Sunday, through the end of August and into the beginning of September.
Any final thoughts you'd like to give us about the exhibit? Well, what people, I mean, we talked about what they can expect, but I know you're still putting it together, but, you know, how is this for you personally to be able to help curate Joel's work?
It is,
that's big.
Such a gift, and he would be absolutely thrilled. It's just a gift to both of us, and I'm really excited. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak about him. Very proud of him.
Oh, I can tell, and a great body of work, and people should go see it. His work is degrand.com. That's degrand.com, and also available under the same thing, Joel DeGrand on Facebook. The exhibit is Iterations Beyond Photography, Joel DeGrand. It opens August 16th, running through September 15th. The opening reception is Friday, August 16th, 5 to 7. And there's a gallery walk and talk Friday, August 16th, 4 to 5. And Meg and yourself, Amanda's going to be leading you through there. And we appreciate you coming on Art of the Air and sharing Joel's journey and your own journey together. So
thank you.
Fantastic. Amanda Fryman, thank you so much for coming on Art of the Air and sharing your art journey and Joel's art journey.
Thank you so much,
Dan. Thank you, Amanda.
Coming next week on Art in the Air. Our whole show features an entertainment power couple, Larissa Julianas, a live event performer, actor, published scriptwriter, artist, and CJ Julianas, producer-director of live theater and movies, discussing their indie film, The Misadventures of Mistress Maneater. Our spotlights on the 4th annual NWI Superstar Singing Competition that supports the Wounded Warrior Project. We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art in the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operation for Lakeshore Public Media, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's station manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air. We rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or send us information about your arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.